Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
For so many women around the world, there's been a rising hope and desire for action to stop violence against women. We can see women's anger in the global Me Too movement against sexual assault, the March for Justice in places like Australia, or the growing horror at how war has had such a devastating consequence for women in particular. But anger and hope are one thing. Building an organised movement for change to tackle violence against women requires something else entirely. Today's Changemaker Chat is with Martha Jeffcott and Charlotte Fisher from the UK organisation Love and Power. In this UK special episode, we meet the two founders of a remarkable women's organising project that is seeking to place women's experience at the centre of social change and community support when it comes to dealing with violence against women. Martha shares how her experience of living with domestic violence has shaped how she seeks to design spaces to support women to build their ability to lead change that can end the culture of violence against women. Charlotte shares how her journey to find community organising as an alternative to traditional charity and advocacy worked, helped her forge a partnership with Martha to begin Love and Power. Together, we explore the importance of seeing our experiences as women as something that is a product of public systems and public life, and not simply a result of private behaviour or experience. This is an unusual episode where I speak to two changemakers together, and I just want to warn you that like many conversations between passionate, powerful women, at times, there may be more than one voice at a time. I hope you can delight in the energy that sat behind this and forgive any technical glitches that it created in the recording. This is an episode that is all about love and power, one of those dramatic paradoxes that lies at the heart of powerful social change. So, let's go. I'm Amanda Tattersall. Welcome to Changemaker Chats, conversations with people changing the world. Changemakers also produces episodes that are feature stories about social change campaigns. Changemakers UK episodes like this one are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the UCL Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. We're broadcast on Acast as part of the Iconoclast Network, so you can find us there as well as on all the usual podcast apps. You can find out more about Changemakers on our website, where you can also sign up to our email list. It's changemakerspodcast.org. Hello, Love and Power, Charlotte and Martha. Welcome to Changemakers.
Woo! We're so excited. This is the best way to start a Monday morning.
We are so excited.
I love that you're excited because the ridiculous nature of time zones means it's late at night for me, but I am excited too because I've got two amazing female organisers on the phone who juggle children and drama, and I'm juggling children and drama, and it's all fantastic. So... And we're going to talk about Love and Power, which is a fantastically novel feminist organisation that's based in the United Kingdom. But before we get into talking in detail about that, I actually want to ask both of you, I'm going to start with you, Charlotte, and then go to Martha. What kind of change maker are you? We always ask our guests this, and I'm keen to understand how you would categorise the kind of change maker that you are.
I am a community organiser, and I like Alicia Garza's definition of that as the messy work of bringing people together from different backgrounds and experiences to change the conditions that they are living in.
Nice. And good on Alicia Garza. She's a bloody excellent organiser. Blessed that she inspires all of us.
Yeah, great organiser, great podcaster.
Hey.
Clearly, that's great for you now.
There's lots of great podcasters, and I'm honoured to be in her shadow or in her space. Martha, how about you? How would you? What kind of change maker are you?
I have really struggled to land on one word for the kind of change maker I am. What I would say is, I think
you don't need to have one word.
I don't know. Podcasts aren't usually one word, are they? So I should have really assumed that this was a lengthy answer. But I
was just going to say, I've had plenty of men with lots of words. I think as two women, you're allowed to have as many words as you need.
It's a feminist act. So I would say that I'm a blend of a change maker that really takes my childhood seriously. I grew up in a household with domestic abuse. I worked in the women's sector for a really long time, and then was privileged enough to meet Charlotte and get involved with community organizing. And I think violence against women is quite systems based, and community organizing is very relationship based. And those three things are what I try and blend in my professional life.
Oh, I love the fact that you're honouring your childhood experience in your daily practice as an organiser. That feels very important, not just for this conversation, but actually for bringing real groundedness to the kind of work that we do.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, and we, it's going to be actually a really important conversation for this work, not just for this work, for this podcast, because we're going to be talking a lot about what is needed for a feminist movement, and a kind of feminist movement that speaks to systems and not just effects of violence or effects of inequality. So we're gonna move both through each of you with Charlotte and then Martha. Tell us a bit about how you came to this work. So, Charlotte, you say you're an organizer. I love that you're an organizer. I too have spent much time identifying as an organizer. How did you come to see that as the practice that was so important to you?
Amanda, can I also ask, how do you define yourself? Because I've just heard you say you spent a period of time identifying as it. Do you identify as an organizer still?
Oh, yeah, I do. But you know what? I really, thank you. That's very kind of you to answer the question back. I also really resonate with Martha's comment about, I didn't grow up in a family with domestic violence, but the idea of honouring difficult lived experience is also something that I feel as part of me. I've got bipolar, my mental illness is something that I have wrestled with, but also I think community organizing activates. And so I also identify with that as well, right? So there's a few different elements to how I see myself as a public person.
Wonderful.
But I'm going to flip the switch back, because as nice as that is and relational as that is, appreciate it. Charlotte, how about you? Again, you say you're an organizer. Tell us some of the journey that brought you to that.
So I'm a Londoner. Like a lot of Londoners, neither of my parents are from London. My mum is from a city in the north of England called Bradford, born to a refugee unaccompanied child. My dad is from South Africa and had to leave during the country's fight for democracy. My mum is actually a rabbi. When she was ordained, she was the eighth female rabbi in Europe, so it was relatively new, and she used her power for a lot of good. She was in a context where, for example, in our tradition historically, babies that died under 30 days after birth were not buried in marked graves, and that probably comes from a time when infant mortality is really high. But she used her power as a female rabbi to change the decree and make sure that for people, when it was really painful, they could recognize their loss. But she also faced a bunch of sexism. When she applied to the training college, they said to her, "We actually already have a woman. Would you like to come back in a few years? We have one." And she had to sign a piece of paper to say that she understood that just because she was being trained didn't mean that anyone was going to hire her as a female rabbi. And what I learned from all those kinds of experiences put together was lots of things. But one was, when the proverbial hits the fan, in the absence of structural justice, it is ordinary people's kindness that is going to step in. I learned that kindness is great, but it is no replication for systems change. And organizing gave me kind of two big possibilities. The first was, I grew up in a world where I saw lots of people doing the right thing, fighting for the right thing, but they were often quite lonely and exhausted, and sometimes they didn't win. And the second was, it gave me political imagination of what caring community could be. So I grew up the rabbi's kid. I grew up in a massive family. I grew up with all these kinds of joys. When my youngest brother was two, he got diagnosed with cancer, and he was treated on the NHS, praise be to the NHS. But in pediatric oncology, where he was treated, there weren't spaces for parents to sleep nearby. So you had like loads of sprawling adults on the floor trying to not abandon their kids whilst they were going through treatment. And the hospital he was in didn't have a lot of money. And every kid had a video and a TV that they could play stuff. I mean, this is showing my age somewhat. But every TV was wired to the exact same frequency. So if you rewound your kid's video, you rewound every kid on the ward's video. And obviously, that's a nightmare. You don't want to interrupt someone else's child's like video whilst your child's just doing it, but your child needs something while they're going through treatment. And my community were amazing in that people brought lasagna, people checked in on me and my other brother, people cared, people, do you know what I mean? Maybe knitted things, they wrote cards, but it wasn't in our political imagination at that point that one of the things we could have done together was to organise for our hospitals to have more funding, to organise for paediatric oncology, to have beds for parents as well as children, to organise for TVs that weren't all wired to the same system. And organising for me was really a route into winning and winning with joy and kind of deepening your community and the imagination you had for what it could do.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. I love the fact, the idea that people, the kindness is what gets us through, but kindness without systems change is not enough. I feel like that summarizes so many people's experience.
Yeah, I think I've got lots of feelings on it. I like Cornel West's, like, you know, justice is what love looks like in public. I've got lots of feelings on kindness versus niceness, how that relates to gender. But I also want to give space to Martha to talk because we have so many things to say in this world.
So many things to say. So Martha, tell us about your journey into making change.
So I find that when I talk about my experiences and what got me to this work, I have to hold a lot of nuances. One, to honour lots of people's story. This isn't just my story. I'm one of four. It's my parents' relationship. This isn't just something that happened to me. And I think we're not very good at talking about domestic abuse. I think when we see things in the press, we're often looking for a goodie and a baddie. And of course, in some cases, there is a goodie and a baddie, but this is such a complicated thing to talk about. We're talking about violence in families and all the complexities that brings. What I would say is that my parents had an incredibly complicated relationship. You know, I would still describe them as the loves of each other's lives. My dad was a really charming, charismatic, fun, amazing dad in many more ways than he wasn't. But that isn't to say that he couldn't be incredibly cruel. He was an alcoholic. He was incredibly abusive. And our home was ruled really by coercive control before we even had a term for coercive control. And my mom is an incredible, brilliant, strategic, like fiercely intelligent woman who was often typecast in a really different way when people hear about her experiences of her marriage. So there's so much complexity in this, and I think lots of abuse survivors can feel this and resonate with this. But I, like one in seven children in the UK right now, was raised in domestic abuse. And there were so many times, and I could tell you a million stories, but there were so many times where, you know, we didn't have the language. We didn't have terms like domestic abuse, like coercive control. I didn't have an understanding of what patriarchy or sexism meant. And the public narrative that was happening all around us in society and in our wider networks were the women's sector won. You know, feminism happened. It's fine. Everything's okay now. And that was so far from our experiences. That was so far from the life that we were living. And that was an incredibly isolating experience. And I felt very othered. I know my mom felt very othered. As I say, the way that we talk about abuse is not fit for purpose. There was one incident particularly, which I think about all the time in the work that we do now, where after the police were called, social services came. It was a huge, huge incident of abuse in the home. The police came the next day after taking my father away and posted leaflets through the letterbox. Me and my mum and my brother were still in the house. Me and my brother are the two youngest. And the leaflets were of a woman who was holding a baby. She had a black eye. She was crying. She stood in a doorway. We've all seen that image when people are trying to get survivors to disclose domestic abuse. And of course, that is the reality of some people's experience domestic abuse. And I really don't want to downplay that. But I am yet, in all the years working with domestic abuse survivors, to meet a survivor that reads themselves into that image.
Yeah, well, it's such a powerless image, and that's actually not what's going on in domestic violence.
I totally agree. And my mom's reaction to picking up that leaflet, bearing in mind it's less than 12 hours since my dad's been taken away, was to say, how outrageous. What if I was really being abused? What would happen if he came home and saw this?
Oh, wow.
And that is exactly what we're talking about. you know, there wasn't any communication going on with my mom to describe and explain what she was experiencing. She's an incredibly smart woman, and she saw herself quite rightly as a strong woman who was helping an incredibly complex man and trying to keep a family together. That yeah. is the way that we need to talk about domestic abuse. So I worked in the Violence Against Women sector for a really long time. I felt really personally let down by them as a child. I continue to feel let down as an adult. I don't think we're doing a very good job when it comes to working with domestic abuse and survivors. We other survivors, even though we know that 1 in 3 women go through this in the UK, they don't read themselves into these systems. They don't read themselves into this experience. And what organizing has done is given me a lens to say, actually, in my childhood, the people that helped me were my friends and family and the community. They're the people that got us out when Refuge wouldn't take my mom because we had a teenage brother. That's the solution. Relationships are the solution, and the sisterhood is the solution. And that's what we're working together to achieve at Love and Power.
Oh, Martha. Thank bloody hell that you and have found others and are standing up and speaking this, because it actually takes people with this experience to be able to change the experience for others. So, I mean, and even just what you just mentioned then, that you couldn't get into a refuge because you had a teenage brother, I we could get into that story further, but, you know, like, speaks to some of the problems that if you're not in this sort of small box, the system is really not able to help you in ways that we kind of thought that it could and would, but isn't, like, that we need to change our approach to the system in order to be able to have something that is designed by those who are going through this experience rather than those who think they know how they're being nice for others, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it's the difference between with, not for, right? You know, if you build something with people who are experiencing this and with people who've lived through this, the situations and the solutions that you're going to come up with might actually work. Which might be a shocking thing, but
shocking that the knowledge of those who are affected is exactly what the system needs. Shocked. Well, let's talk about that knowledge, right? This episode is in some ways dedicated to that knowledge, because Love and Power is an organization that is seeking to change the system based on the knowledge and experiences of those who have been affected by violence and want to create a system that's is able to respond to their needs. But before we get into the vision, I actually think it's helpful for our audience, for me to hear, like, let's define the problem, right? So tell us about this. If you've mentioned the system, you've mentioned the way in which violence is treated currently. I mean, you're both in the United Kingdom. I have a feeling it's true. It's true of other places too. But tell us about the problem that Love and Power is seeking to overcome. And one of you can arm wrestle each other and work out who's going to go first.
It's awkward, slightly sisterly, and like trying to figure out how to not talk over each other on this podcast. Yeah, I mean, if it's not true somewhere else, let us know. We'll happily move, right, Martha? I mean, we're keen to find out if there's somewhere which is great for women. But yes, I mean, basically, our analysis is people go through the world and experience sexism individually in their own lives. So women might get discriminated at work. They might not get paid enough on parental leave. They might get harassed. They might experience violence. They might have opportunities denied to them because they're women, whatever it is. But because we experience it individually and not, we don't have moments come together as a collective, we think it's about us often. Or if we want to change stuff, we're funneled into systems that only ever can deal with things on an individual level. So the criminal justice system, the therapeutic mental health support system, or things like tribunals, healthcare systems, all are about how do we support you as an individual. But these are really at their heart structural collective problems. And the only way we're going to solve them is by coming together to actually change the underlying structural collective conditions. But there's something that happens. I mean, Gloria Steinem talks about it as moving from personal fault to collective fate, where people often think something, because it's happening to them and they're experiencing it personally, is on some level their fault, their shame, their responsibility, they're a reflection of them. When actually these things are really, it's really, really hard to navigate as an individual. And actually, in most cases, it's impossible in the systems we've built. So I think about this. I organise care workers and care recipients for a long time around living wages, better conditions. And I think about a woman I work with who had a mum who was this kind of ball busting, like amazing pioneer in her career. She became an elder. She needed social care. And her daughter comes in one day and finds the mum in her own urine. And this daughter sitting in a cafe telling me how she feels like she has failed her mother, who was, you know, very immaculate in personal care, really always on managing her house and managing her life, to find her soaked in her own urine. And through the course of the campaign, when she would meet actually predominantly female and in London, disproportionately migrant care workers, was care workers would say, I get given 15 minutes for a personal care appointment. I don't get paid sick pay. So if I get a cold, I'm put in this impossible position. Do I not go to work and not get paid and not make my rent? Or do I take my infection to a vulnerable elderly person? And we built teams of care workers and care recipients and everyone's family together, because it wasn't anyone's individual shame. The system was broken. The care workers were frustrated because they weren't able to care for people the way that care actually should be. And the care recipients felt like they had failed their family members because this care was so bad, and were also concerned about, you know, the job that makes all other jobs possible. What is it like? You know, you don't want your care worker who cares for your family to not be paid a living wage so that they can't go back and care for their own. And really, so much of our work is about how do we build people in that under, you know, yes, there's a specific campaigns that people build, but really it's that underlying thing of moving people from personal fault to collective fate, realizing that it's not your personal shame. And then how do we understand this to actually solve it together, rather than dealing with your personal situation, trying to make sure your individual loved ones are okay, which is exhausting, but just also not sustainable.
Mm. And you know what I find fascinating about that perspective is, you know, feminists famously talked about the personal is political in the 1970s, right? And talked about the need to politicize the home. But you're talking about another dimension of that sort of dynamic or paradox between public and private, which is that if we think of everything as private, the other problem is that we don't see the systemic social pressures that actually put pressure on women's lives. Like, it's like the personal is political, and also the public is public, and we need to recognize that the public is all over our lives too, and that means that it requires a different kind of change to it. Like, it's very like, I feel like it's a powerful extension of a long argument that we're familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to let Martha jump in a minute, because otherwise I'm going to be the talking one in this. But I think all the time about how, on one hand, you know, even though we are deeply frustrated with where the women's sector has gone, how we stand on the shoulders of feminists who came before us, but also how that I think of so much of organizing as building mental landscape, of helping people to think about their own life, their own imagination, to understand that in ways that link our stories to other people's stories, on the basis that ultimately in lots of ways our fates are shared. And I think this is a really important part of it, where because we experience things personally, we think they're part of the private sphere. And actually, lots of how sexism works is really personal to women. It can go into intimate bodily violence. It can go to the home, all kinds of things. But it's not, even though it's personal, it's not just your family. It's not something just about you. It's actually collective. It's structural. It's, as Martha says, 1 in 7 kids are growing up in the UK in domestic abuse. And we can't confuse personal for being only about ourselves.
Yeah. Yep. And if it's not just only happening to you, if it's happening to everyone else, then the system is what's going on. So Martha, I was going to twist it. I mean, you probably have lots to say on the first question, but I feel free to come back at me more on that. But I was actually going to say, okay, yep, I hear you. The system at the moment has got some problems, albeit they're better than it has been, right? We all stand on the shoulders of the generations of people before. So I guess I'm interested to understand how Love and Power is doing things differently. Like, how actually are you being different to the way in which we've, you know, what does that look like practically?
So I think there's two main ways I would like to answer that. One is about who feels this movement is for them and this organization is for them. And we've been really, you know, people come up to us all the time and work with us all the time who say, I've experienced X, my sister experienced Y, you know, we were pushed to a workplace tribunal, we were pushed to make a police report, and it's not necessarily just about domestic abuse, just the stings of patriarchy. And they're looking for something that actually solves the issue they're going through. They know that what they experienced wasn't about them, although it was very personal. It's a systemic issue, and they know that, and they want to make life better for, you know, the people that follow them. So, you know, we've been really, really bowled over by people sort of accessing us naming and articulating that as a key motivator. And the other thing is, you know, I was not involved in big campaign spaces. I was much more Violence Against Women for a long time. And I grew really sick, and I know I'm not the only one, with any time I wanted to make a change, I'd be emailed a petition and then no one would talk to me again. You know, and that would be it. There was no way to meet anybody. There was no way to learn how to do this. There was no way to have access to the things that people from my background, you know, like a working class background from Birmingham, would have access to be able to do this work. And Charlotte and I, we had a year where we'd built the misogyny hate crime. That was going really well. I trained the officers to recognize and respond to misogyny hate crime. And we saw the Women's March happened. With like bated breath, so excited. This movement that we keep looking at each other in meetings, waiting to happen, is going to happen. It was 100 years since some women got the vote in the UK. The Me Too movement rolled around. And still, there was no way for me to meet anybody, have access to that training, do anything other than sign a petition to make change on this, or to occasionally go to a protest that wasn't super strategic, and I couldn't really see how it was going to make a difference. And if it was rainy, I kind of didn't really want to go because I didn't know anyone else that was going to go. So all those things is exactly the DNA of Love and Power. So we're really concerned with, are we actually winning? Are we actually ending people's suffering or easing people's suffering? Are we offering a different image and way for people to relate to each other, to build this strong network that we know we're going to need to really take on the patriarchy? And, you know, we take people's time, money and energy very, very seriously because we know this is precious work. And the people, the motivations that got people here are complex, and we hold all of that.
And what's interesting to me, like, you know, mobilizing, right? You know, the digital campaign bonanza that's gone on for the last 15 years of sending out petitions and building lists. And in some ways it's like, it's not terrible, right? It has a purpose, but it holds the leaders of that movement are the people who are sending emails, and the strategists of that movement are the people who are sending that emails. They're often staff, they're often white, they're often middle class, they're often well-educated, they're often sitting in London, or they're sitting in my place, they'll be sitting in Sydney or Melbourne, you know, and it's doing something, but it's not doing what you're describing. You know, like it can do some things. It can scale an issue. Me too. We're all recognizing that, and that plays a role. I think that to me it's interesting, it plays a role, but can't do what you're describing, which is for people who've experienced this violence to then lead the transformation of the system so it is able to, in a sort of never again, you know, like this doesn't need to happen to another person. That only happens with a different kind of people power, a different kind of work, which you're arguing is organizing, which is, you know, it's pretty exciting. Charlotte, thoughts? Oh, no, Martha, jump in.
Charlotte will have a really articulate and wonderful explanation of this from an organising point of view. But just to bring it back to feminism, you know, we're a feminist organisation existing within the patriarchy. And we know that the systems that we have frustrations with mirror the patriarchy. You know, it's like explaining what water is to a fish. You know, it's everywhere. And my frustrations when working in the women's sector was that there was no analysis of how much really almost a paternalistic sector undermined survivors and really replicated abuse tactics and dynamics. You know, we aren't here to save anybody else. We're here to work with you if you want to save yourself and save your community and work with your community. That's the difference. So it's the way we're working is inherently feminist because that's the model we're working to. And Charlotte, I know you'll have lots to say on this from a community organising point of view.
But it's also not just organising. Like what you're talking about is like a modelling of change, right? Be the change you seek, this sort of prefigurative idea that the actual way in which you work with people has to embody the kind of society that we want. And the idea of a feminist practice is bloody important when you're organizing with feminist principles and with women. I think that there's something incredibly powerful about that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, one of the big distinctions of organizing and mobilizing is something that one of your previous guests, Jay McAlevey, has written about, which is those petitions get everyone who already agrees, and we want to build the people, like we want to build and increase people who want to come part of it. But also, you know, and again, like digital organizers and digital mobilizers, it's not a net negative, but there is something for me about how do we help build people's capacities, appetites, skills, ambitions, dreams before, like which you can't do via a digital petition. How do we deepen relationship across difference? But I also do worry in our sector, and this might be a very inner, you know, organizing to organizing conversation, what our incentives are for that create metrics of change, like how those systems encourage us both to have vanity measures, but also to frame things for people in sensationalist ways of like, sign this petition to end animal testing. And I think if there is a sin in organizing, it is not being honest with people about what it will take to build the life they need, mm-hmm. not being honest with people about their time, energy, because money, because I think it encourages people to lose faith. You try something, you realize signing a petition doesn't weirdly end animal testing, and then you think change can't happen. Mm. The real point of organizing in many ways is teaching and building skills and capacities to make that change.
Yeah. Like, I mean, if we say sign this petition, it's going to fix something. I mean, it's a bit like conspicuous consumption. Right. Like, you know, that we do that. That's a consumer culture, you know, buy this, sell this, buy this piece of change. Whereas organizing, for better or worse, and don't get me wrong, it's got its own weaknesses.
Frustrations.
Yes. It's got its own frustrations, but it's kind of like a lifelong thing. Right. You know, it's that hilariously somber quote from Saul Alinsky where he talks about climbing a mountain and then the peak clears and then he realizes it's good to climb further and you climb up the mountain more and the peak clears, you've got to climb up. That's organizing, this sense that we are resourcing ourselves to be climber of change. It's a much bigger task than any one win. I want to ask you both about this capacity building question, because I'm sure if there's anyone listening to the conversation who's in an organization working with people, any affected community, right? A community of people who are affected by a problem that are wanting to lead that change, you know, to build the capacity of those people who've not been, you know, in quote unquote activists before. They're passionate because of their lived experience and they see themselves as capable of doing more. How do you take people on that journey? Like, what are some of the steps or ways in which you find people? You've talked a little bit about some of the steps. I'm just wondering if there's other key elements to that process that where people are able to find their own leadership and power in working with you lot.
Yeah. I mean, also, I love what you're saying about the climb, because I think it links to what Martha's saying, that this work is ultimately generational work. It is work that if it's good, will go beyond us. And that is a good and right thing. But it's also work that we are moving back in generations, thinking about what we wished our own mothers had, what our own childhoods could have had, and what we wish for, you know, future generations. I mean, absolutely. We divide this into all kinds of different ways. So I think, you know, our training is divided into three of a combination of organizing skills like feminist theory and like personal reflections and skills and attributes. But I think some of it you learn also by doing. You have the experience where you meet someone, you make an assumption about them, you have a one-to-one, you realize, wow, you were wrong. You get more curious about people, person you never thought would ever join for you, joined with you, and then you won something that you didn't imagine. And the more you win, the more you begin to imagine for yourselves. We also, and this is my personal bugbear about kind of lefty movements. I mean, we're not politically affiliated left to right, but this is definitely my personal bugbear about the left, where I was tired of movements jumping up, grabbing headlines, and then 6 months later being embroiled in infighting or collapsing into, you know, navel gazing. And I grew up partly in South Africa and spent most of my 20s in South Africa and really learned a lot from political movements there. And I'm a South African citizen. And one of the things that was very common was a training program that lots of different activist movements put people on. And we have a version of it. Ours is very uncatchily called Intersectional Feminist Bootcamp. We've got one for under 18s and one for adults, where we talk about the stuff that I think is about not everyone agreeing, but everyone having shared language so that we've got the basis to be able to have conversations 6 months down the line. So we look at gender, race, class, why we're a trans-inclusive movement, the history of how white women's safety has been used to justify and create measures that particularly target black men or men of colour. We talk about all that stuff front and centre. We talk about the legacy of feminist activism. We talk about the organising strategy and how do we think about it. And we front and centre it when other organisations might say, oh no, that's too tricky, wait till you have better relationship, or wait till, you know, you need it. Partly because if you've got shared language, you can have a lot of those trickier conversations much more easily down the line. You don't have to agree. That's all right. No one's going to agree on everything. But to be able to come from a starting place is important to us.
Martha, do you want to, have you got some thoughts to add?
I guess there's something for me around, and because of, you know, my experiences growing up and things like that, I feel that I've been surrounded by women who would have really benefited from the feminist movement. You know, there were stings in their life that were sexist and gendered, and yet they weren't part of that movement. You know, they were either isolated from that movement or left behind by that movement, or you know, in various different ways made to feel that that wasn't for them. And we always say that Love and Power is a party that everybody's invited to. You know, it's something that is really built in honor of, you know, people who've been traditionally left out of conversations like this.
I love it. It's a party that everyone is invited to. This is where I want to have a discussion. Like, we don't have endless time. This is the sort of final juicy issue I want to get us having a talk about, which is, you know, like, often women's politics, feminist politics, is based on the idea that women's of sameness, right? Women, we come together because we're similar. We must have similar experiences. But, you know, we also know that sameness exists in tension with the idea of difference. How, I mean, you've mentioned, Charlotte, about the training and the role of training up front, about the sort of intersectionality. You've talked about how Love and Power is a trans movement, so that can be difficult for some, but it's not for you lot, because you're an inclusive space where you want people to have experiences and relationships with each other. Just talk me through this dynamic around, sameness and difference, and how it manifests as part of who Love and Power is and how it seeks to build love and power.
Amanda, I feel like I could talk to you about this all day. I think, so Martha and I met not at Love and Power, but through building the campaign around misogyny, hate crime, which in some ways was a great training for this, because all women experience misogyny, right? You can be Gwyneth Paltrow, rich, white, blonde, thin, and you still have to deal with the Harvey Weinsteins of this world. But also, women do experience misogyny differently depending on their rest of their like life experience. So in our campaign, we had sections that were, we had our Northeast chapter was based at Newcastle Central Mosque, and women were dealing with gendered Islamophobia or Islamophobic misogyny, however you want to frame it. Our chapter in the Northwest was based in Manchester in a students' union. And we had lots of Jewish women, Black women, young women, queer women, Muslim women sharing their experiences. And for me, this is kind of the heart of it, which is like, we all face sexism, and we all face sexism slightly differently. And the joy and meaning of building community where you're not trying to conflate everyone's experience as your own. You're not, you know, Martha and I come from different backgrounds, and regularly Martha will say to me, Charlotte, that is not right. I want to do this more like this. I think that would isolate people from where I'm from. Or I say to her, wow, Martha, do you know what I mean? That would ring differently in my community, because the association we have with X or Y is Z. And for me, that is the joy of a good party. It's not all the same. It's the people that are different, but that you have enough in common that you want to work on a shared goal. And part of us fronts and centering training is to flag that, because I think people feel more comfortable in sameness sometimes. So they want to kind of rub over differences. And really part of our party is like, okay, this is all going to be the joy of being with people that aren't all the same as you. And you're going to be able to build things that are bigger than what you could build if it was just the same. And it's quite front and centered. In some ways, Martha and I think have that in our own personal dynamic too, which is we're from different backgrounds, and it comes up all the time in joyful and funny ways.
What strikes me, and maybe this is taking the analogy of the party too much, is that on the invitation slip, it's the expectation and the knowledge is that it's going to be intersectional and different. You know what I mean? Like, it's the basis upon which people are joining the party is that they're going to meet people who are different to them. And there's something culturally so important in sending that signal to people. It strikes me that that's a huge part of it.
This is Priya Parker's work, right? The job of the host to convene, to set, you know, the party starts from when you first hear about it, the invitation. You set the expectations. You set how you expect people to talk about. So, you know, we have a section on our training, which is called Love and Power is Not Twitter, where we basically talk through what is the culture of the internet? What is the culture of social media based politics? And it's not all bad. And let me not sound self-righteous in it, because I have a horrifying number of accessories I've bought via Instagram. But the point is, I want to explicitly say, this is the kind of culture that you might expect on social media. You might expect people to respond really quickly when things happen. You might expect everything to be able to be simplified into an infographic or into 160 characters or however long Twitter now is, X now is on characters. You might judge whether something's good by the instant reaction of whether people like it or don't like it. You might, you know, in the kind of spectrum of support, I think of Twitter as active support, talking to active opposition. That's not what we're interested in here. Our Love and Power's job isn't to go out and have a debate with people who are deeply committed to sexism. And so how does our culture look, and what does that look? How does that look different? And I was really worried about it at the beginning. I was really worried that people were going to hate it. It was going to be deeply countercultural. People were going to think it was all sellout. And what I've learned for me, and I'm sure Martha's got different views on it, is people were craving a space to figure out how to be together in difference. People were craving a space where there was good faith. There was an assumption that if you were here, it wasn't because you were trying to cause trouble, where you could learn. And one of the things we hold really centrally is everyone's politics should have changed in the last 10 years, because if not, what a waste of 10 years. Like, we're not, everyone's on a growing journey. Everyone's on a learning journey, us included. And that's not a bad thing. That's not something to shame someone about, of like, wow, I think in 2012, you once thought X. Otherwise, what a waste of the time since 2012, if you haven't gotten smarter or kinder or more interesting on something. And that, taking the assumption that therefore everyone is on a journey, everyone is smart, and not everyone has exactly the same access to the information that you've had, is a really useful frame of how we put through everything.
So, Martha, I mean, for you, come at this question in all the ways you can, but as in particular, as someone who's come in with your own experience, and then you've experienced the system, how have you found this, I guess, the role of being able to hold and be open to difference, how that's, I know how you've encountered that, how that's become important to you, how that's changed you in your process of being involved?
What an amazing question. Like Charlotte said, I could talk about this all day, but it does go back to the modelling for me of, you know, I am who I am because of these experiences, like all of us. And so one example might be, obviously, we have lots of conversations with funders and things like that. And I find those conversations incredibly stressful. Financial abuse and coercive control were my dad's MO when he was at his worst. And there's something for me around like reclaiming money. So we, Love and Power is a dues-based, membership-based organization. There is something beautiful as a financial abuse survivor of saying, we, as the people who are, we're working together with Love and Power, are going to fund this movement, and we're going to take our money seriously, and our money is going to be part of that salvation and part of that collective action. That is a beautiful thing. And it's, I always talk about like turning the pain to power. There's so many things like that for me in my experiences and everybody that we work with, where there is a new way, there is a different way. And it's about being imaginative about what that way might be. And there's so much richness and so much we can have in common when it comes to that stuff, because we've all survived the patriarchy. We're all like navigating a different world for the people that follow us. And there is so much shared ground in that.
But you know, what I'm hearing in what you're saying, just to say, it's like the experience of what could have come across as a distinct experience, this financial abuse, is able to be, in a movement that listens to its people, is able to be lifted up as a strength and form of power. I mean, that is just, I mean, that is, I guess, It's a powerful representation of what you get when you have a movement full of people who are different, and we respect difference as a part of our power, right? It's just a great example of that. Now, we could have had this conversation and gone on for several hours, because you're both very interesting, and I normally only talk to one person, but I had to talk to both Love and Power. I had to talk to both of you.
Yeah, thank you for breaking your golden rule. We hope when you're in London next, we will be able to.
Well, this is true, yes. Right? And you know, you only have rules in order to break them. But here's my final question to both of you, which is just, I'd love to know, you know, you've done this work, you've come at it from different perspectives. How has building Love and Power changed you?
Wow, what a question.
Who wants to go first? Go for it, Martha.
How has Love and Power changed me? What a question. I feel that it's like, first of all, it's the honor of my life. You know, it's a beautiful, wonderful thing. And I really hold the fact that, you know, you couldn't get a credit card until the 70s in the UK as a woman. And all the women in my life and in my family line who have been unable to have access to like personal wins, let alone professional wins. So I really, really hold that. And you know, we're an organizing organization and it would be a huge swing and a miss to say that my personal and professional relationship with Charlotte hasn't changed my life. Like, so much of this comes from the deep love and connection we have for each other as women, and the way that we relate to one another and work with one another and care for one another and inspire one another. It's, you know, meeting her changed my life. And I think so much of the love that you can see from us as an organization is really just our like love letter to each other. And we know that as we build and as we grow, that story is going to happen a million times over. This is going to be about women and feminists loving each other and showing that love in public. So that's how it's changed me.
Oh, that's bloody excellent. And it's a love story, but it's a love and power story. It's a love story in public. I love it. I love it so much.
As Martin Luther King says, it's anemic and sentimental, and its power without love is reckless and dangerous, but love and power together are the magic combo.
Yeah. And how has it changed you, Charlotte?
I mean, listen, Martha and I are absolutely a love story, and like all... Aijen Poo's got a piece about how good organising is like a love story generally of falling in love, intoxication. And I would say Martha and my relationship is absolutely about love for each other and love for the building of a new world we're creating. It is also a love letter to lots of other people in our lives and situations in our lives. And I think one of the things for me is it has allowed us to change the story. It is the joy and energy of seeing a group of teenagers go on training, realize that their domestic abuse provision was rubbish and it was ruining their family's lives, and then organize with their MP to change things. It is the joy of possibility and hope and bringing in a new world. It feels for me like the closest thing I have to a life's purpose, in that sense of like, this is the world I want to build and this is the people I want to build it with.
Oh, I've got the goosebumps. What a thrill. I'm so glad I broke my rule and we've got both of you on this show. We couldn't have done it without you both. Love without power, as you say. Thank you, Charlotte and Martha. We're going to put a whole bunch of details in the show notes if people want to be able to follow and research further about the amazing work that you both do. Congratulations on everything that's happened so far, and we can only hope that it explodes and explodes, not only throughout the United Kingdom, but that you get calls now from Australia and New Zealand and America going, oh, we want to join the Love and Power movement. Let's fingers cross that, and I wish you the best of success.
It is lovely speaking to you, and I'm sure you have your own love and powers in all these places, and we can't wait to connect with them.
Thank you so much for having us. This has been a real treat.
Changemakers is hosted by me, Amanda Tattersall. Remember to subscribe to this podcast to catch all of our episodes. This is Series 8, people, so there is plenty to be inspired by in our back catalogue. You can find out more about love and power in our show notes. Changemakers audio producer is Jules Wookera. We're broadcast on Acast as part of the Iconoclast Network. Changemakers UK episodes, like this one, are supported by the Civic Power Fund and work with the University of College London Policy Lab. They bring together extraordinary ideas and everyday experience to understand how we can change the world. Check them out at ucl.ac.uk/policy-lab and civicpower.org.uk. Like us on Facebook, Instagram and Threads at Changemakers Podcast. We're on Twitter X at Changemakers99, and I'm there too at Amanda Tats. You can also check out changemakerspodcast.org for transcripts and updates on all of our stories.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.